Aloha, I'm Bill Dorman, in for Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us on The Conversation. It's Thursday, June 4th. We hear from Governor Josh Green this morning about the future of Hawaii's energy resources. Does the possibility of liquefied natural gas mean less solar power for the state? South Kona residents are picking up the pieces following a series of earthquakes, including a magnitude 6 quake just before Memorial Day. One resident said the shaking just would not stop. How many evacuation routes do communities need to save lives during a fire? Why 6 seems to be the magic number? And we followed 10 local high school seniors in the week before and after graduation. We hear how they celebrated their achievements and look to what lies ahead. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Bill Dorman in today for Catherine Cruz. Governor Josh Green has until the end of the month to release his intent to veto list, but he says even the usual suspects like the state budget are not likely to be on the chopping block. 87 bills from this past legislative session have already been signed into law, including measures to limit corporate spending in elections and to protect reproductive health care. We spoke with the governor this morning, and he was definitely upbeat about the results of this year's legislative session.
You know, I have great appreciation for what the legislature did this year. They gave me 268 bills that will become law. It's highly likely almost all, if not all of them, will be signed by me. I have to say I really appreciate also their super hard work on protecting the tax breaks for our working families and our Alice families. That was amazing. So they did great work on that. Usually, there is at least one bill that goes on to the intent to veto list, which is the budget, because you might do some line item vetoes of smaller projects. I might not even do that this year. I mean, they really worked hard to give me a balanced budget and to make sure we have enough revenue. So that was great. Also, the legislature gave us some landmark bills. They gave me a bill, which I've already signed. I've signed 87 of them, by the way, 87 out of the 268 bills already. Not with a lot of pomp and circumstance. I'm just working hard every day to get this into law, these bills they gave me. But they gave us a bill to, you know, block dark money the best we can through a state process. And that was quite innovative, and I appreciate it. So, you know, I appreciate them more than usual this year, the team, the gang. I like them very much. I've even made my peace where we had a bump in the road here or there with a couple senators, just because, you know, we get up in the moment.
You know, you mentioned the work on the budget, and we've all seen the forecast of the expected hurricane season this year. Many folks still dealing with the aftermath issues from storms we've already had. How confident are you that you have the flexibility in the budget to deal with what you may have to face in the storm season coming up?
I'm very confident. That was an excellent bit of work that the legislature did, and special mahalos to, you know, Representative Todd and Senator Dela Cruz. You know, what they did was, we first authorized $175 million of monies that had been previously restricted. We always save money towards the end of the year just in case, and we had a just-in-case moment when we had a month of rains and 2 trillion gallons of water that flooded, you know, a lot of our beautiful state. So we handled that part, that kind of intermediate phase of the recovery, but they also gave me $100 million of latitude to deal with the upcoming fire season and what is going to be likely 5 to 13 hurricanes this coming year. So it's serious. We already authorized $1 million, for example, of advanced fire prevention with the National Guard. I had $500,000 left over from before, but this gives me the capacity to have an on-call team to drop water if any fires break out. And sometimes fires happen as a result of the hurricanes passing the islands, which is what happened in Lahaina about 3 years ago. So I've got the resources that we need. We would always be ready to come back together if there was something that was urgent enough to care for our people, but they've trusted me with that extra resource, and I'm appreciative.
Another situation right now that's kind of fluid, the Strait of Hormuz, as you know, remains closed, and of course that blocks the flow of oil into Asia in particular, and affects the supplies for refined products, including jet fuel. and yes, with nearly all of Hawaii's imported jet fuel coming from South Korea. I'm wondering what contingency plans might be in place for the state if there's an extended disruption, particularly in the supply of jet fuel.
I met recently with Parr, as recently as last night, in fact, and you know, I just wanted reassurance that we have a supply, and we do. It's usually several months out, and they feel comfortable with where we are. If the war does go on for several more months, everyone in the the country and across the globe is going to struggle somewhat. I will tell you, I also have gamed out the possibility, if gas prices continue to stay high, that we might suspend the state and county gas taxes, which would lower the price of gasoline by somewhere between 30 and 50 cents a gallon. We could do that for 30 or 60 days just to help people out in the middle of summer if necessary. I'm hoping the war ends. I'm not a supporter of this war. And if the war goes on and there's still conflict in Iran and the Strait of Hormuz doesn't open, we're going to have a lot of bigger problems because it will begin to curtail. Well, first, it's going to hurt people. Innocent people are going to die and our soldiers are going to be in harm's way. Second, it's going to curtail travel to Hawaii because of the premium cost on air travel, and you will see a downturn and a softening of our economic picture if that goes on. So we have to hope that this war ends for many reasons. One, that I believe in peace. Two, I believe in protection of our soldiers. And three, I have to protect our economy.
And when you look at Hawaii's vulnerability, do you look at that with some sort of a timeline with the Strait of Hormuz?
I do. I think actually that they need to resolve this matter this month, this calendar month in June, because I think that the way that the structured buys go of oil throughout the world usually does take some time to ramp up. And if it continues and there's a gradual reopening of the Strait of Hormuz, it could really throw us for a loop as far as the supply chain goes. So I think that's going to happen. I've seen some signals. You know, I'm like everyone else watching CNN and you know, the multiple news stations to see what's going on. But I also do reach out sometimes to the military leadership and even into some of the cabinet to find out how much progress they're making. It does appear they're making progress. I think this war will end in June. I really believe that.
We've been hearing from Governor Josh Green. After break, we'll have more of the conversation, including a discussion about Hawaii's energy future and the possible role for liquefied natural gas. Stay with us.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Aloha Air Cargo, offering 5 direct flights weekly from Honolulu to Seattle-Tacoma Airport. More information at AlohaAirCargo.com.
Some call it soccer, some call it football, some even call it the beautiful game. We'll get into the surprisingly complicated history behind the many names for the sport in multiple languages ahead of the World Cup. Hear that and the day's top international headlines next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Gas, offering tips to help local residents and businesses prepare for natural disasters and emergencies. Learn more at hawaiigas.com/safety.
Welcome back to the conversation. Let's return to our discussion with Governor Josh Green. Last year, Hawaii entered into an agreement with JERA, the largest power generation company in Japan, to explore the potential use of liquefied natural gas in Hawaii. This morning, we asked where that situation stands right now.
I think we're going to have a deal between JERA and HECO as soon as June 8th and maybe a couple weeks later, but I'll be meeting tomorrow with some of the HECO leadership. I constantly am in communication with both parties. The reason we want a broader energy base is because of things like this war in Iran, because we lost a lot of the subsidies for solar, both at the federal and included in that some at the state level. We can talk about that a little bit here. And I think diversification to our fully renewable future is smart. And that includes gases, which eventually is going to be hydrogen gas. So what will happen, I believe JERA will build a 500 megawatt power plant, which ultimately HECO will have an opportunity to be a full partner in. Also, I believe they will reach agreement on significant investment in the state of Hawaii, likely $2 billion, and that's how you make all this affordable. Conversations I've had at the national level include with the Secretary of Energy, and Secretary Wright is working on a massive, very low-interest loan for HECO so that they can modernize our energy grid. It does include the use of LNG because that is one of the biases of the current administration. But I'm trying to make sure that we have a very balanced, broad approach, and that includes a massive amount of solar and a massive amount of renewables, and then a bridge set of bridge fuels, which includes using less oil and a little bit more LNG or some LNG. But let me actually pivot just a little bit to something that happened. You know, we were wrestling with the budget and the taxes for our state, and we wanted, and I'm really, again, appreciative of what the Senate and House did to keep all the tax breaks in for working people. But some of the solar tax credits went away, and there was one concern, and I think we're going to all work through this, but one concern was projects that are already underway, especially the commercial projects. So I'm working that out, and I've given assurances to people that I will handle that because I think projects that are already on the books for 2026 do need to, you know, be honored. So even if it requires an executive order, I'll do that. Just to clarify that we don't do a taking. I really appreciate what the Senate and House did to keep all the real serious tax breaks in place. But the solar industry did take a body blow in that way. And though they'll still be able to do a ton of solar for families that make less than $350,000, individuals less than $175,000, and so on, these bigger commercial projects, which are helpful to our grid and renewable energy, I think do need to at least be honored for 2026. So I'll handle that. I will put out an official letter or EO, executive order, if it's necessary. But we go forward, you know, and that's how I look at energy.
And Governor, you, of course, understand the optics on this. People see some cutbacks on the solar tax credits coupled with more of an engagement with LNG, which is a fossil resource, and wonder if this is a drift away from commitment to renewable energy future for Hawaii.
It's not at all. You know, this was proposed under Governor Abercrombie and at the time Lieutenant Governor Schatz, that the use of some LNG, a modest amount, to be a bridge is better because otherwise we're the state that uses more oil than any other for our energy, which is bad. You know, using oil specifically from Libya is unhealthy for us, and it is a very long process to go to exclusive solar and maybe an impossible process to go to only solar. So we need lots of solar. We need some wind. We need some LNG. We need some geothermal. And that will help us get off of the most dirty fuel, which is oil. And it's important that we do that. As technology catches up, there will come a time where air travel will be more efficient. There will come a time where we can use more biofuels. But the time isn't now. And so we made a mistake not having a more balanced energy plan as long as, say, 10 and 12 years ago. We should have done that because what it did is it condemned us to a lot more greenhouse gas problems over this last decade than we needed. And I'm just taking on the problem. I've become very aware that a lot of major problems were kicked down the road. People kicked the can down the road decades on homelessness. They kicked the can down the road on renewable energy and a transition to a real energy sustainable future. And that's not good. And so once I became governor, I was forced to deal with some of these challenges or the shortage of housing. And that's why I had to use some executive orders and push these things. I understand that there, you know, in a perfect world, we'd like to only have renewables, you know, on January 1, 2027. But when I don't have a federal government that will help us with that, and I don't have a way to get off of oil otherwise, I have to actually look at other options. And that's really where we landed.
Previously, the idea was expressed that it would be an affordability issue. The shift to LNG would save money. Now some of those figures and assumptions have been changed. But apart from affordability, you see other benefits from LNG and specifically this deal with JERA?
Well, first and foremost, it is an affordability. We still believe we can get 15 to 20% savings. And keep in mind, I'm bringing $3.7 billion of upfront investment directly to the challenge, $2 billion from JERA and $1.7 billion from the federal government. I also have been informed that I'm likely to get a $100 million bonus grant for energy infrastructure, and I'll likely go to Washington, D.C. and collect that money for us sometime later this summer. So there's some very compelling reasons to think that affordability is going to be delivered on this plan. But, you know, what you see, though, is there's a lot of vested interests against such activity. And that's just politics. That's people fighting for their own space. And that's okay. That's what everyone does. But I don't buy it. And I don't have the luxury of punting these problems while our people suffer and struggle with, you know, the lack of affordability. That's why I'm building CalHOLE, because we're not going to tolerate a lot of people being homeless on the street. That's why we're building housing aggressively, because I'm not going to wait for another generation of local people to leave. And I'm not going to wait for our energy prices to continue to go up 10, 15% a year. And every time some president of either party goes into a conflict, that it hits us hard. So, you know, I'm preparing us for a much better future, but it means that I have to actually ask some of the tough questions. And I realize they end up landing, you know, on Hawaii Public Radio or Civil Beat or anywhere else. But, you know, I just don't think it's prudent for us to take any kind of simplified view of these large, complex problems. We have to actually begin to solve problems as a state, or else we're going to really languish in the next decade.
Governor, thanks for your time today.
I appreciate you. Take care.
It's been nearly 2 weeks now since a strong earthquake hit South Kona on Hawaii Island and was felt through much of the state. They're still putting together damage reports, and Savannah Harriman-Pote has been talking with some of the people hit by that and county officials about what comes next. She joins us now with an update, and Sav, this is an area that is used to earthquakes, but people you spoke with told you this one was a little different. How so?
Yeah, absolutely. So folks familiar with South Kona know that it sits on the slopes of Mauna Loa. So these little tremors that we get related to volcanic activity are really common. But many of the people that I talked to said they had simply never experienced an earthquake like this that was so intense before. One of the people that I spoke with was Toni Simons, and she's lived on Hawaii Island for nearly 50 years. And it was nearly 10 p.m. when the earthquake started, so she was already in bed with her husband. And so when the shaking first started, they thought they were just going to wait it out.
But this one did not stop. It kept going. It was very long. And you're laying there going, is this going to end? Is this going to end? And then it's going and getting stronger and stronger. And that's when we said, oh, no, this is going on. And things started falling in our home. You could hear the glass breaking. And so we just jumped out of bed, and our little dog almost got hit by a mirror. And we go, oh, this is bad.
Whoa. And so after all that shaking, what have the damages been like?
So Simons actually gave me great insight into this question as well, because not only was she near the epicenter, and so she experienced some of the worst of the quake firsthand, she's also the West Hawaii director of Vibrant Hawaii. And this is a community organization that has set up resilience hubs all across the island, and they become a really important partner with the county on community-led disaster response. So immediately after the earthquake, you know, Simons is still bracing for aftershocks. She's also on her phone with her colleagues, and they're sharing information about what has happened. And by the next morning, they've taken a community needs assessment form that they developed during the recent Kona low storms and retooled it so that it could be released alongside the Hawaii County Civil Defense's official damage report form on Saturday. And there's a lot of information about what people are experiencing that have come from those community needs assessments. Simons told me that in the days since the quake, they've gotten about 80 requests for assistance, and people have wrote in to ask for temporary housing because their homes were destroyed or structurally unsafe. She said some people were trapped at home because boulders had fallen onto their driveways. And she said one of the most common requests was for assistance repairing or replacing water tanks.
Yeah, that point about water tanks is something that's gotten a lot of coverage. We've heard about damages and also lingering impact on water supplies. So what more can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so South Kona is a largely rural agricultural region. And, you know, I feel like in Hawaii, the common question is, where do you go to high school? But if you're in this area and you go to someone's home for the first time, you often ask them, oh, are you on county water? And so many people, especially those who live on the steep upper slopes of Mauna Loa, they don't have access to county water. They rely on rainwater, which they collect in water catchment systems. And the earthquake seemed to have taken a particularly bad toll on those systems. I spoke to one farmer, Mark Takizawa, who has been farming coffee on about a dozen acres in Honau now since 1986. And he had a big old tank made of redwood slats, which is a type of tank that they don't really make anymore. And he told me that the shaking during the earthquake was just too much for it. It essentially burst, and thousands of gallons of water immediately rushed out of it. And now he says it just looks like a pile of giant popsicle sticks, and he thinks it's beyond salvaging. But Takizawa considers himself to be lucky in some ways because he actually has another tank that is connected to his main house, and it only sustained minor damage, so he's kept water access for the most part. Other people, like Kaylin Santana, have had to haul water up to their properties and use makeshift systems since the earthquake.
We have two water catchment tanks, and the one near the house just totally collapsed, flooded under our house, and we lost all the water naturally. And then the other one that we have up above, it didn't actually collapse, but the liner in it gave way, and so we lost all the water. So we were virtually without water for 2 days, and then we started hauling water in 5-gallon containers until we could get family and friends came and helped us hook up a temporary system that we're now using until we can get water tanks back up.
Boy, that really changes daily life so much when water's hit like that. So what comes next for folks like Kaylin Santana?
So their interim measure is they're going to public spigots and taking big water totes that hold about 275 gallons. That's enough water for Kaylin Santana and her husband for 3 days. They've reached out to the companies in the area that install water tanks, but they're, of course, inundated with requests. So many people are on a holding pattern on that front. And then there's also a question of how to pay for repairs, especially for farmers in this region who operate on really, really slim margins. And earthquake insurance is generally optional in Hawaii. Few people have it. I reached out to the USDA's Emergency Conservation Program, which recently offered farmers some relief during the Kona low storms. Their acting director for Hawaii County, Keenan Fuji, told me that they are working to open funding in response to the earthquake, but it's not yet available, and it could take a couple of weeks. And they can cover up to 75% of the costs of some of repairs, but on a pretty narrow set of structures. So just things that have to do with irrigation, like dams, ponds, and pipelines. It is possible that water catchment tanks will fall under the category. That could become one option. And then meanwhile, Civil Defense has received more than 400 damage reports since the earthquake. And this week, county officers are sifting through those to identify where the damage is most severe and then conducting site visits to get documentation. And they're going to try and use that documentation to make the case for federal FEMA and Small Business Administration assistance.
You know, you mentioned those Kona low storms, and it sounds like the aftermath of those storms could have been a complicating factor when it comes to the earthquake and now the recovery from any earthquake damages.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that still looms large. Actually, many of the farmers that I spoke with also had to deal directly with impacts from those storms, mainly flooding and, again, rock slides. Some said that those storms were actually harder on them than the recent earthquake. Santana told me that her driveway was blocked by rockfall and debris after the storms, and she and her husband couldn't get out for 3 days. They ended up hiring a mini excavator so that they had road access again. But, you know, beyond just the Kona low storms, nearly all disasters have a really long half-life. And something like an earthquake can be over in 20 seconds, but you might be dealing with the damages for 20 years. So an example that really struck with me, Caitlin Santana, she has these retaining walls all across her property to make the steep land usable. And she said that those walls had damages during the most recent earthquake. She's expecting it's going to take between $40,000 and $50,000 to repair them. And this has actually happened before. In 2006, during another quake that looms large in people's memories. At that time, Caitlin Santana got a low-interest SBA loan to repair her walls, and she told me she's still paying that two-decade loan off today. And so it's hard to know exactly how long the recovery process for the people affected by these most recent events will truly last.
Thanks, HBR's Savannah Harriman-Pote. She went to high school on Hawaii Island. And you can read her story online at hawaiipublicradio.org. The Maui wildfires exposed the dangers of communities without enough evacuation routes. These so-called one-way-in, one-way-out neighborhoods were the focus of a special HPR series on fire vulnerability back in 2024. Now, a new study addresses a key question. How many exit routes are enough to save lives during a fire? Six seems to be the magic number. Kat Fong grew up in a small town in Southern California with one road in and one road out. She's a researcher now at the National Center for Ecological Analysis and Synthesis at the University of California, Santa Barbara. When her cousin suffered through the Eaton Fire last January, Fong looked for a way to apply her training in geospatial mapping to wildfire risk and resilience. The first step in the research was to build a database that didn't yet exist. Fong spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender about combing through California's so-called red books and news articles to compile the names and locations of every wildfire death in America since 2008.
This was the single hardest thing I've ever done as a researcher. I cried in my office for weeks. I had to close the door so people wouldn't think that like I was sick or ill. Like it was emotionally devastating to go through and read about the people who died and to just understand that like this is a place where the people who are dying are the old and the vulnerable and the young, and that this is a preventable outcome. And just really sitting with that for the last year or so has been challenging.
Yeah, I can imagine. The fact that it's preventable must have made the work feel especially important. And then when you collected this database, essentially the first of its kind with wildfire fatalities, and you were able to map the roads of individual communities and put them together. And if I could have you talk about what's going on in figure one of this paper. So describe for listeners what you and your co-authors found.
Yeah, so we tabulated all of the wildfire fatalities that we could find in the last 20 or so years in the U.S., and we assigned all of those fatalities to a community where those people lived. And then for each of those communities, we were able to count the number of major roads that intersected with the boundary of that community. So the number of roads in and out of that community. We accounted for the population size, so we were calculating the fatality rate, and then we looked at the cumulative fatality rate as you decrease the number of roads. And what you're looking for is you're looking for a really big change in that rate, and that change is indicative of when something different is happening. You're trying to identify a threshold. And we found a threshold at around six roads, where once you hit six or fewer roads, the cumulative rate of per capita fatality starts to increase exponentially. And so what that means is that there's this threshold, which is a very useful policy heuristic of six roads. Six roads or fewer, and you likely do not have enough exits in the event of a wildfire. More than six roads, so seven or more, and continuing to add roads accrues no more additional benefit. And so that very steep threshold is probably the most important finding of this paper, because it helps identify where your risk landscape is, what that looks like, and then you can apply that information that we have from actual fatality data. You can extrapolate that out to the rest of the US and say, okay, well, how many communities are like this, right? How many places are at this threshold or lower? How many people live in those communities? And then how does that interact with our current understanding of wildfire hazard? So where are, or how many people live in these communities with too few roads that also have elevated wildfire risk?
And just to put that finding in other words for listeners, one way in, one way out communities are significantly risky when it comes to wildfire fatalities, but so are two exit communities, three exit communities. It gets less and less risky until you hit six. Do you have any reason or thoughts why six seems to be a magic number?
Yeah, I've thought about this a lot, because when you put out a number like that, you should think about it a little bit. And I think that it has to do with road redundancy into and out of a community. And the example that I would point to when I think about this stuff is the campfire and what happened in Paradise. So Paradise has six major exits. So it's right at that threshold for risk. And if you read the after incident reports for what happened in Paradise, there was construction that was causing delays and lane closures. There were burnover events where the fire crossed over and blocked roads. And so there were roads during the evacuation process that were not usable. And I think that that's just a reality when you're going to have an evacuation. You're going to get congestion. You're going to have burnovers. You're going to have debris. You're going to have accidents. And so I think that having six roads builds in a level of redundancy that can help build resilience and buffer that community from being egress limited. So I think that that's what's going on with the six roads thing. There are cases, though, and I think that Lahaina is a really important one to think about. There are cases where I think the orientation of your roads matters, too. So Lahaina is a tricky place, I would imagine, for developing evacuation plans, because you have two exits to the north and two exits to the south, but those exits are in parallel. So I would hypothesize that in many ways they're functionally redundant, because if one burns over, likely the other burns over. If there's construction on one, there's likely construction blocking access to the other. And so I think that there's a component of road number and also road orientation. The orientation was really hard to get to in this particular study, but pulling out, again, Lahaina as a very specific example, I think it's another layer or another piece of information that is useful when thinking about evacuation planning.
And let's stay on that topic of planning for the future and taking this research and hopefully using it to influence not only policy, but city planning. So what could that look like?
I think that implementing this finding into policy is going to be a little bit complicated, right? The simplest answer, when you look at figure one and you see that dramatic threshold, I think most people's gut instinct is going to be like, oh my gosh, we need more roads, right? We need more roads out of our community. But that's not necessarily a realistic solution or a desirable outcome in a lot of contexts, right? So building more roads means more development, which might not be something that aligns with the community's value. We also have some pretty good data that a lot of wildfires that start with human ignition start along roads. And so there's a bit of a double-edged sword there, where if you develop more roads, you may also be developing more points for ignition risk. So I don't think that building more roads is necessarily the pathway out. I do think that knowing that you're below this threshold of 6 can help inform better planning and response for individual communities, though, that's irrespective of developing new roads. So we think about 2 main levers that communities can pull when they're trying to manage this risk. Evacuation planning and early evacuation systems, warning systems, and options for people to shelter in place. So how can you basically ride out a fire in your community without leaving? Evacuation is incredibly stressful, and it carries a lot of its own risks, including physical and mental health risks associated with evacuation. So there are many, many people who would prefer to shelter in place if given the opportunity. So I think that being really thoughtful and strategic about developing, they're called like temporary refuge areas or places that you can go where people can gather and they don't necessarily have to evacuate. They don't have to take on that additional risk of leaving their home and potentially losing all of their documents and losing access to their local pharmacy and being separated from their family. Like, there are ways to shelter in place that I think are underexplored in the wildfire landscape.
But it seems like one of the things you're saying is that at a baseline, we should be able to identify which communities might be at highest risk, inform community members so that they know they live in a high-risk community, and then we can start to think about how do we change the built landscape or change our respective preparedness. And so as we wrap up here, I'd love if you could share a little more about the interactive tool that you and your co-authors put together for people to figure out based on the communities they live in what their risk level might be.
Yeah, so I think it's really important to make sure that you translate the information that you find into a platform that's usable for an everyday audience, for a community member, so that the information that you spent so much time working on is accessible and useful. So with Carlo Broderick, one of the authors on the paper, we worked together to build this interactive dashboard that we call Wildfire Evacuation Risk Across U.S. Communities, where we've mapped about 30,000 communities in the U.S., and you can interact with the dashboard. You can find your particular community, where your friends and family live. You can hover over the dot that identifies your community, and it will tell you what the community name is, what state it's in, and it will tell you where you fall in the exit vulnerability. So do you have 6 or fewer exits? Do you have 7 or more exits? And then it will also tell you what hazard classification you're in. So is your burn probability low, medium, or high? I think this is a really useful way for citizens, community members, local city planners to better understand what the risk landscape is for themselves. And then if you are somebody who makes these kinds of decisions at a state level, like for the state of Hawaii or for us, for the state of California, you can compare across the different communities and try to identify what places need prioritization, where you should be investing effort, what communities likely have enough roads. And that can help you be a little bit more strategic in where you invest effort, because doing these kinds of community planning, making evacuation warning systems, deciding what those thresholds are for triggering evacuation, developing these refuge centers for during a wildfire, it's time, it's cost, it takes time to communicate that to the public and to plan it, and it can be expensive. And so being able to understand this in a really digestible format was something we were really motivated to do for this project.
That was scientist Kat Fong of UC Santa Barbara and HPR's Maddie Bender. We'll have links on our website to that interactive dashboard where you can see the wildfire evacuation risk for your own community. Head to HawaiiPublicRadio.org after today's show.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Zippy's, celebrating 60 years of commitment to supporting island businesses, sourcing local products from beef and eggs to papaya and noodles.
Saturday night on The Real Deal, we'll celebrate the birthday of guitarist Grant Green, who gave us so much great straight-ahead jazz, and at the end of his career, some tremendous soul jazz, too. Join me, Seth Marco, from 8 to 10 Saturday night on HPR 1 as we celebrate Grant Green.
Support for HPR comes from the Hawaii Employers Council's annual Talent Summit, June 26th at the Ala Moana Hotel, bringing together stakeholders to address workforce challenges. Registration at hecouncil.org.
So, high school graduation is over, and you've crossed that commencement stage. Now what? A new special project from HPR's D.W. Gibson documents this pivotal moment in our students' lives. We featured the voices of 10 graduating seniors from Kapolei High School yesterday. HPR asked these students to keep an audio journal in the weeks before and after graduation. Today, we bring you the second part of the project. We pick up 1 week before graduation.
Graduation is in about 7 days. So excited for grad, but I'm so not excited for grad practice because I know it's going to be so hot.
Today, I got all my signatures from all my teachers, which means I could graduate and walk the stage. I'm very proud of myself.
Grades are finalized, everything's in, certificates in, all the special stuff. It's nice being done with everything. Really puts into perspective like how close we are.
I am super excited. I am super relieved. I feel like all of my hard work paid off, and I can't wait to see all of my friends graduate.
I'm really kind of stressed out. Like, I'm excited, don't get me wrong. But on Thursday, when I got my nurse aid certificate, I started crying because it set in that, wow, it was my last day of school, and then I might not see these people after graduation.
My favorite part about this week was senior day when all my juniors, sophomores, and freshmen, they threw this little party for us in our academy. Like, they got us food, giving out certificates, stuff like that. That was the best part of my week. Because I never really had nothing like that before from schools. I just want to have fun and make sure I don't do anything kind of not responsible so it doesn't jeopardize my future.
This week, I got to pay my respects to all of my teachers and the school staff who helped me throughout my 4 years of being in high school.
I could finally take a breath after all of the projects that I did, and I could finally just focus on being happy that I made it. I still have a week before I even get there, and I have to go to mandatory grad practices, which I'm not too stoked about. Kind of wish I could just put on the cap and gown and shake a few hands and call it a day, but here we are.
This is it. This is the end. Life hits. Things are gonna start changing. Friends are gonna they're not gonna be around as people are usually used to them being, like, every weekday. Obviously, more free time for the seniors that are graduating, getting jobs, going for sports, going to college. Yeah, that's pretty much it. I mean, senior life is gonna hit pretty hard soon. Crazy.
I'm recording this literally right after my graduation. It was incredible. You know, we spent the whole week preparing for it and practicing and then rehearsing the formations and the songs we were going to do. And I think you did a good job with our songs and stuff. And, you know, it was just, it was so incredible to see everybody, man. And we, and the laying ceremony, dude, I have so many lays that I got to give out somebody. And I feel so good, bro.
I remember just finally getting ready, grabbing everything, grabbing a ton of bobby pins to make sure my cap was going to stay on my head. Because, of course, it was freaking windy. And we finally walked out. It was like all the people and family standing there. I was like, damn, this is like actually my graduation. And then waiting in the bleachers, it wasn't until like the row in front of me stood up and it was like, oh my gosh, it's happening. Like, this is like the real thing. And when it was finally my turn to stand up and walk down, I was like, oh gosh, please don't let me fall. And then finally walking on stage, oh, like a dork, I almost missed grabbing my diploma. I turned the wrong way, but I quickly fixed it, got it. And I was looking out and it was like, I was looking but not looking. I was kind of like blacked out in the moment.
Up until the moment I walked across the stage during graduation, I was thinking about all the memories I had made. The laughs I had with my friends and the talks with my teachers about my grades, my thoughts from freshman year through senior year piled in my head.
Seeing all my family crying and sad, it was really nice to know that they all loved me enough to come and see me and support me, and it was really wonderful. So as graduation has happened, I honestly still feel the same. I still feel like I have school tomorrow. I still feel like I have assignments due, like nothing has changed. And I know it'll help me soon, but right now that's what it feels like. It feels like I'm still going to school, that I still gotta pack my bag and pack my lunch for the next day. It's really weird.
As you can probably tell from my voice, I think I partied too hardy and I stayed up a little too late.
Graduation was really fun. I got my girl back.
My grad party, it was so much fun. My mom planned the entire thing. She spent months on finding decorations and everything. It was Dia de los Muertos themed, and it was everything I could have asked for and more. Now that graduation is finally over, and a few times where I've driven past Coppola, I have cried and realized, like, I'm not going back.
Some of these people I might never see again. I have the best friends on the planet, man, and so much, like, all my class are my friends, man. And it was so incredible to graduate and move through this journey across all these years with them. I don't know if I can take all the appreciation people have shown me. Like, I don't feel like I don't know if I deserve all of it. It's crazy.
This is the week after graduation. So a lot's happening. Family's been coming over and, like, you know, giving praises, putting lays on me, which was pretty cool, and just talks about the future. I've already had plans to take an internship on the mainland, so I fly out in 2 weeks. There isn't much I'd say I wish I would have done more, other than maybe learn to dance.
Now, like, that sad aspect is like taking over, but besides that, I'm really happy to graduate and I am so excited for summer.
On Friday, we graduated, and that was probably one of the best days of my life. One thing about my week that was really challenging for me was leaving, saying goodbye to a lot of people, and getting ready for all the new challenges that are coming my way. Knowing that I'm gonna grow up and become an adult and have to care about more than just myself and my friends. And I'm gonna have to think about my actions, how it's gonna affect me, my peers, my friends, my family, my everybody that's really around me. And it really scares me.
I was beyond happy. I was beyond blessed because not only was I able to graduate my class and be celebrated about my graduation, I actually made it, you know? I didn't think I'd make it. You know, I didn't think I'd be alive to walk the stage. I didn't think I'd be healthy enough to walk the stage and graduate with my class. I beat all the odds. I beat cancer. I graduated, and I became valedictorian on top of two honors. Let's go, Hurricanes!
Life is starting. People are getting jobs. People are already, like, fresh out of high school, already starting college, which is nuts. Crazy to think how, like, just after graduation, just complete life change.
This summer is going to be pretty packed. I'm also going to be working a bunch, and I'm just really excited. I've been looking at dorm, like, essentials, so I'm not sure what else to buy, but I know that looking to the future, I'll be looking at if I should get a computer, what I should decorate my dorm as, and really just what else can I do with the money that I'm hopefully going to be saving up.
Just trying to get down and, you know, learn these life skills, these practical life skills I'm going to need in the future, building into college at UH Mono, and I'm just gearing up for the jump, you know, in independence we're all going to take, and we all need to, and, you know, it's just all development, man. This school, Kapolei High School, will always be incredibly important to me. Once a hurricane, always a hurricane, you know what I mean? This school has built my confidence, and it has allowed me to, like, build the confidence that I can help others and people appreciate me. It's truly selfless to be a teacher and a staff member at this school, man. I can't thank you guys enough. I love this school. I love you guys. Thank you so much. Hope you guys are having a good one. Hope everyone had an incredible graduation. You all deserve it, bro. You guys are incredible. I feel so happy right now. What a time, man.
Voices from graduation at Kapolei High School. HPR's D.W. Gibson produced this special segment, and you can listen back to this audio project on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. And congratulations to our 2026 graduates. That is the program for today. Up tomorrow, we have a Hana Ho show planned, taking you to the front lines of the climate crisis and hearing directly from Pacific Island voices about the places they call home. Give us some feedback. You can call our TalkBack line at 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Find the conversation on our website or on Spotify or Apple. I'm Bill Dorman. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.